As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Total Soccer Show and our latest Champions League roundup. In the final tranche of round of 16 games, we have two penalty shootouts, two runaway league leaders eliminated, a 41-year-old defender doing good things, an on-loan Man United player doing great things, and Marcus Thuram really putting the squeeze on Atletico Madrid. Well, on at least one of Atletico Madrid. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, your friend and mine, Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, my friend. How are you?
I am wonderful, thank you. It's been another week of Champions League.
Yeah. It has indeed been a week of Champions League. Yes, sir.
It has indeed. Joining us to discuss this week of Champions League, it's Joseph Lowry of Arizona. Hello, Joe.
These games were fun. I don't know what you guys are on about. Every time you come in and we're complaining about stuff. No, these games are fun. I enjoyed them. Extra time is a stupid rule and we should get rid of that. But the rest of these games genuinely were good and entertaining and I'm excited to talk about them.
We got rid of our away goals. That's one good step in
progress.
The right direction.
Progress.
Right. Yep. Good. I'm with you.
I see. Do we all agree with that? Because
no,
I believe our final co-host doesn't agree. There we go.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think it helped with the Inter-Athletic game last night. But other games, not so much.
I'll introduce you shortly, Graham. But why do you feel that way?
Drama. It's basically my reason. Drama.
Graham, would you... Going forward, should we have it be like the Graham Ruffin switch, where they just have to come to you and you can decide if away goals will count or not?
Yeah,
and that way we can kind of determine
Phoenix.
If it's going to be good? Yeah, exactly.
Thumbs down.
Yes.
Thumbs up.
Yes. It was Joaquin Phoenix who invented that, yes.
He did indeed. Graham Ruffin with us here as well, ladies and gentlemen. Before we get to the Champions League action, patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow is where you'll find our bonus content. It is the best way to support our endeavours here at Total Soccer Show as well. Bonus episodes, bonus videos, access to our Discord, lots of good stuff on there. Joe Lowry with a little video behind the scenes of his first commentary gig.
Love that video. Love the subtitles. That was the best bit about
you. Well, so here was the problem. To peel back the curtain, I started out, so I was getting ready, and I sort of recorded a little pre-clip at home, and then I got to the stadium, I recorded something, and then I just completely forgot to record anything until after the game was over, and I realized this video sucks. Like, this is really not entertaining. So I had to add in some high production quality elements on the back end, but I'm hoping to do more, because I'll be out at a bunch of games, and I want to try to show some of the behind the scenes of how the different on-site broadcast elements work. But game one for me was a little bit more about don't screw up on TV, don't screw up on TV, don't screw up on TV. Next time, I will try to take some more video liberties.
I caught some clips, Joe. You did very well. I've said before, you've got the natural rhythm for co-commentary. The fact that you didn't include any of the match footage or anything during the game, nothing to do with the fact that Phoenix lost? No, nothing?
I confessed it after the game. I said they lost 1-0. I thought they were the better team. I referenced expected goals, and Ryan hasn't messaged me angrily about it, so I know that he didn't watch the full video yet. So all in all, I thought I was pretty forthcoming. But Popmar Boy, player to watch, freshman out of Clemson from last year, now a professional soccer player, was excellent in the middle of the back line and has a great name. Go watch him play soccer.
I, I have thought about creatively editing my Stirling Albion videos. Like on the Patreon, Stirling Albion have made it to the Champions League. Like we haven't lost a game
in
2 years.
It's just a Football Manager save, is what it is at that, at that point.
Yeah, it's the next video. The subtitles do make it, Joe. And yes, I did listen, and I heard my shout out. Thank you very
much. All right,
good. Much appreciated. Good. Also on there, going on the feed very shortly, indeed, as we record our top five USMNT moments of all time. Find out what they are. Patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow. In the meantime, let's get to the Champions League action of this week. We'll start with Tuesday's games. Why don't we go to the Emirates first, with Arsenal getting a 1-0 win over Porto. 1-1 on aggregate there. Arsenal going through 4-2 on penalties. This was, Graham, the first Champions League penalty shootout since the 2015-16 final. Yeah. That one blew my mind. Didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
And then Wednesday night's shootout was the first penalty shootout that we'd had in the Champions League since the night before. Two at once in 1 week. Yeah, I in terms of this match, this was the most engrossing match and tie of the round. Not because it was a good match. It was a terrible match by all the usual measures. Very few opportunities, not much rhythm. Porto did an excellent job of disrupting Arsenal, preventing them playing through just as they did in the first leg. But I thought it was fantastic to watch. I really enjoyed it because there is a joy to watching a team executing a game plan so well as Porto did. And you got a sense from early on that this was going to be on a knife edge when we previewed these games earlier in the week on the Patreon. We kind of predicted this, right? That Arsenal would eventually break them down, but they would have a tough time doing so, given what we'd seen from Porto already in this tie. This was the optimum outcome for me because while I did enjoy Porto in this tie, it's a little bit like Morocco at the last World Cup, where you can enjoy the underdog story, you can appreciate what they're doing, but once you get into the latter stages, you just kind of want the best teams playing good soccer. So I enjoyed Porto. They did very well here. They executed their game plan very well, but Arsenal moving into the quarterfinals is probably the best outcome for the tournament as well.
You've said at least twice there you enjoyed Porto in this game. Can you expand on that? Because I'm not sure that was the consensus.
I don't know. I enjoy some poophousery, and there was a lot of poophousery from Porto in this game. Much like the first leg, it was a game that was played on their terms. So they kind of dictated the manner of the match, even though Arsenal have obviously more of the ball and are certainly the more proactive team. This match was like this because Porto made it that way. They broke things up. They took every opportunity to go down and take their time on goal kicks. If I was an Arsenal fan, I'd be absolutely raging. This is one of those things that you can only really enjoy if you're a neutral. I am a neutral, so I did enjoy it. But yeah, they stayed compact, kept their concentration. It also didn't totally feel like a team that was just kind of sitting deep and praying to get through to penalties. Porto knew what they were doing. Their game plan worked. They did a good job of taking the air out of the Emirates in the first half. They were happy to have the ball at Diego Costa's feet for as long as possible. They had some threat down the flanks with Conceição and Kvyat, I thought, had a difficult time against him. There was a couple moments where they were good in transition and on the break, which you don't often see against Arsenal. So yeah, I was so impressed with the way that they played over the two legs. I think they played better in the second leg than they did in the first leg when they won that game. They have an identity. They stuck with it. But yes, I am pleased they're out, if that makes any sense.
And I'll drill down a little bit more on the language there, Graham. I think I agree with literally every word you just said. The way I would shift it to make it Ryan approved is to say I didn't necessarily enjoy watching Porto in this game, but I appreciated what they did. And that's been the thing for Porto under Sergio Conceição for years now. They know exactly who they are. And these big games against larger European teams with higher wage bills, with more top-end talent, they know exactly who they are. They're able to sit and defend. And it wasn't as if Porto were just sitting deep in a super low, you know, 4-4-2 block or a, you know, 5-4-1 block. They did some sitting deep. But like you, Graham, I was, actually, maybe you didn't say this, but I was actually a little surprised with how much early possession Porto had. Arsenal, I thought, were slow out of the gates, and they needed to push for a goal in this game. And they didn't seem to have the intensity early on, and it was fortunate for them that they found it. And Trossard gets the ball in the back of the net after a beautiful Martin Odegaard assist. One of the best balls that I've seen in a really, really long time. But Porto in general, I thought, were excellent across both legs. They executed their game plan. If you gave Conceição and this Porto team the choice before this two-legged tie started of having to go out there and play for a win across the two legs or getting it tied and into penalties at the end of the second leg, they would pick the second one every single time. Getting to a penalty kick shootout against Arsenal was a fantastic result for Porto, and honestly just a shame and an excellent performance from David Raya in net for Arsenal that prevented them from moving into the quarterfinals.
Taylor, I don't think this has been mentioned in any other media, but Pepe's 41 years old. Did you
know? He is. I did. I enjoyed the juxtaposition of like his first game against Arsenal versus this game, so you could see the time lapse, and he looks pretty much the same, maybe a little bit less hair, but it is cool to see him starting and playing for Porto. And I thought he did mostly okay in this game. He gets himself a yellow, but stays on the pitch, so no Pepe tomfoolery. I feel like VAR has done away with that for him. But I think I agree with everything else that Joe and Graham have said. I found this one a type of game where it was really difficult to track like everything that was happening. I felt a strong desire to look at my phone multiple times. So maybe I'm not the best person to analyze this one other than to say that David Raya once again reminded us that he's better than Aaron Ramsdale.
Can we do another quick beat on Martin Odegaard? Because I thought this was one of the best matches that I've seen him play. While Porto did a good job of limiting Arsenal, I thought Odegaard was the exception. His play for the goal is just tremendous. It's incredible skill in a tight area, and then the little pass through to Trossard for the finish, just absolutely incredible. And he was feeling himself throughout the match. There was a moment in the second half where he nutmegged a player on the edge of the box, which doesn't quite do justice to what that piece of skill was, because the player is right on top of him and he kind of like rolls it through the legs. Just fantastic stuff. He's such a good player, and he's become so important to Arsenal, not just in terms of his footballing play and creativity and goal threat, but also his leadership quality, which is not something that I really associated with him earlier in his career. But you see the way that he takes the first penalty in the shootout and then gives it like the big roar to the stadium. Maybe that's the natural thing to do. Maybe most players would do that. But nonetheless, in that moment, I think it was clear. And throughout the match as well, just how much of a driving force he is for this team.
Most players might do that. But the way he takes the penalty, how emphatic that finish is, and then he picks it up, it just elevates the energy. And yes, Pepe steps up and gets his, but I feel like you get Odegaard sort of establishing that energy and establishing that like ruthlessness in terms of taking the penalties, and then Arsenal go on to make all of theirs, or all the ones that they took. So it feels like he was a good one to get out in front, and I agree with you, Graham. The leadership, the kind of putting the team on his back at times that we've seen from him has been so critical in their run this season and in this Champions League for sure.
If we're switching the discussion to the shootout, which I know is tends to be your kind of your niche, Taylor, but if it wasn't for... So there was a couple of things I noticed in the shootout. First of all, of course, you have David Raya. If it wasn't for Ronwyn Williams, I would have said this performance was the best shootout performance I've seen from a goalkeeper.
Let's go.
This year. Yeah, flash from the past there, Joe, from like literally a month ago, which feels like a year ago, AFCON. But yeah, exceptional from David Raya. But before, on the TNT broadcast, before the start of the shootout, they highlighted that while Diego Costa had a good record from penalties, he's never saved a penalty from a left footer before, which was an interesting thing to highlight. And then I don't think it was a coincidence that Arsenal's first three penalty takers in the shootout are all left footers. They knew that as well. But yeah, Raya's performance was fantastic. What did you think of the shootout, Taylor? Did you have your diagram drawn out?
I did. It wasn't wholly remarkable. I thought David Raya clearly got a good briefing, and I think gets really good launch. I'm always amazed with how well goalkeepers have been able to start timing that sort of launch, that they always have the foot behind the line, but then still sort of spring out at the exact right moment. The one thing I would like to see more of is the commentators saying ahead of time that the player looked nervous. They did it with both of the misses for Porto after it was missed. It was like, he never looked confident. It's like, I didn't hear you say that before he took the penalty, which it does feel like would be a nice little thing to have ahead of time so they could then discuss afterwards. But other than that, I just thought it was Arsenal just being really clinical and efficient and kind of ruthless in the way they took theirs. I think you could see the nerves in Porto as it went on. And then having David Raya in the form he's in really is the difference maker. So I'm happy to see Arsenal. I'm not an Arsenal supporter, but I think I am, of the two, happier to see Arsenal go through. It feels like we are in a position to have more exciting football with some of the teams that advanced.
To come back to the penalties, Taylor, they were really high quality ones that Arsenal took, though, weren't they? They were all great, I thought.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe they practiced knowing the way Porto were going to play and knowing the possibility that we were going to a shootout. Yes.
Yeah, and it felt to me like all of them were very much, I know where I'm going. I'm not playing any games. I'm not trying to be silly with this. I'm going to do maybe a little bit of an elaborate run-up, but in the end, I'm going to put it exactly where I want to with the speed or with the power and the placement. And I think by contrast with Porto, and then in the shootout that we're still yet to talk about, every single penalty just felt like they were maybe in the not quite the right spot. They were in that sort of zone where it's always going to be easier for a goalkeeper to make a save than down low or up high. And so it felt to me like Arsenal were just sort of knew what they were doing and executed, and Porto, I think, had a little bit of a wobble with some of their takes.
Maybe this is just me as the dictator of Porto, and I'm still a little salty about this whole situation and Porto going out. I'm not as convinced as everybody that Arsenal going through is a win for the neutral. It is a win for the neutral, but I don't think it's as big of a win as maybe the rest of the folks that I'm joined with today do. Arsenal, still in this game, didn't create very many chances. Like, they weren't especially dangerous in possession. That was true in the first leg against Arsenal, against Porto. That was the big problem, and Porto get a banger in that game. But Arsenal just straight up couldn't create. They couldn't take the game by the scruff of the neck and really create chances on their own in the final third. And they have been good in the league, obviously, to still be in the title race at this late of a stage in the season means you've done a lot of things well. But still, I'll keep banging the drum. They have not been this super dynamic, free-flowing, chance-creating team. They have been, for a lot of this year at least, and certainly in these two legs, a defensive possession team, meaning that you keep the ball with the express purpose of trying to deny your opponent's chances, and less so because you're great at creating chances for yourself. So I'm ultimately agree, and I'm kind of splitting hairs, but I just wanted to say this because I think as we go forward in this tournament, and maybe for the listeners as well, this is something to watch for. Like, the thing to watch for Arsenal is not how they control games defensively. It's not how they strike on set pieces, because they are elite at both of those things. It is how do they get Martin Odegaard on the ball? Because, Graham, I do disagree with you on that. They limited his touches, Porto, in this game. According to FBref, he had just 48 touches across 120 minutes of play. He had 65 touches against Brentford over the weekend in 89 minutes. So, and you can go back through and look at more and more and see that this was a quiet game for Odegaard when he was on the ball. Obviously, that wasn't applying because he was fantastic. But when he was off the ball, he wasn't getting on the ball nearly enough. So that is just one thing I'm watching for this Arsenal team moving forward. And if there's anything that's going to prevent them from winning one or two major trophies, it's going to be their inefficiency in possession.
You're forgetting one thing, though, Joe. Nutmeg touches count triple. So
there it is.
Yeah,
you're right.
That's the caveat.
I know that's not a real thing. I desperately want it to be. That would be lovely.
There we go. We'll make that a real thing. We'll get rid of extra time, and the dictator Porto will have his way.
I'm not Arsenal. Even kidding. That would make me ecstatic. Less the nutmeg thing and more the extra time thing, but that's fine.
Very good. Very good indeed. Arsenal in the quarterfinals for the first time since 2010. When we come back after this break, we're going to look at Barcelona's passage into the final eight. Back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our Champions League review. Let's go to Catalonia, where Barcelona had a 3-1 win over Napoli, a 4-2 win on aggregate. Fermín López, João Cancelo and Robert Lewandowski with the goals for Barcelona. Graham, a decent game here. Napoli got back into it around the half-hour mark, but ultimately to no avail here.
Yeah, I said on our Patreon preview on Monday that I really wasn't sure how this match would pan out, and basically my reasoning was that Barca have been poor in most matches that I've seen them play recently. I think I underestimated just how much the competitive tension has gone from their performances in La Liga. I know Joe has mentioned this. They don't really have much to play for in La Liga right now. And some of that tension was back in their performance for this game, because this was more comprehensive than I was expecting from Barcelona. They did a number of things well in this match. They started well. They started with intensity. They were willing to be a bit more direct to get in behind. And there was a couple of warning signs for Napoli early on with a decent opening for Fermín López 12 minutes in, and then of course he scores in this game. I thought this was Rafinha's best performance of the season. His run that splits open the Napoli defence for the first goal, and then it's a nice pick out for Fermín in the middle. For the second goal, it's an excellent counter attack by Barcelona from deep, and it's good movement by Rafinha again. So we haven't seen this sort of performance from him very often this season, but this was good. I thought the defending from Napoli at times was absolutely abysmal, particularly for the first goal, where there was just a giant hole in that defensive line, nobody tracking back from midfield to cover it. But nonetheless, I thought this was a good performance by Barcelona. The caveat is there were some opportunities for Napoli in transition and on the counter-attack, but their decision-making in those moments, at least twice Barca got a bit carried away and had six players breaking forward before then losing the ball. But time and time again, Napoli ignored the sort of like vertical passing channels, if I can call them them, and failed to exploit the space that was in front of them. Their attacks would get bogged down with players taking too many touches, or they would delay the pass. So I think while this was certainly a good performance by Barcelona, they deserved to go through. They were the stronger team. A sharper opponent might have made Barcelona pay more for those moments.
Graham, I like how you sort of lost steam in between saying a good, like good and performance. Like, it was a good performance from Barcelona, which is similar to what Victor Osimhen did for the opportunity he had in the fourth minute. That was a strange moment for me of like, that doesn't seem like the Victor Osimhen we've all watched before, where he's kind of has the opportunity to like take that big touch and get out in front and then be one-on-one with the goalkeeper. It's sort of a couple different, not quite good touches, not quite bad touches, but it doesn't put him in the best position to get a shot away. And in that moment, it kind of felt like, well, if he's not fully up to speed, if he's not going to be the difference maker, this might not be Napoli's day. And that is pretty much how it played out.
Well, that's kind of what I mean, right? There are a number of opportunities or situations in this game where you think, and look, maybe this is my fault because Napoli haven't really been the team to capitalize on those opportunities this season. But my mind still goes back to how they played last season, and in those moments, I'm thinking, right, here we go. Napoli are gonna do something exciting here, and they're gonna get a decent look at goal, and it never really materialized. So that's where I think a better team, certainly a sharper team, might have made this more of a contest.
Yeah. Joe, what did you make of Barcelona's performance in this one with the kids and whatnot?
I thought it was fun. I thought their attacking play was really sharp from very early on in this game. And I thought the defensive play was sloppy, and some of the rest defense stuff for both teams wasn't particularly sharp. One thing I loved about this match, and it was a really entertaining game, Man City's fingerprints were all over this thing. And let me explain what I mean by that. City, in a lot of ways, have continued to push forward some of the tactical trends that we're seeing at the elite levels. I even think about this in the Arsenal game, where it's ostensibly four center backs across the back line for Arsenal in that match. And that's like a Man City thing. Pep kind of stumbled upon that midway through last season, and now Arsenal have sort of trailed behind them and copied a lot of that stuff. The first goal, not just for Barcelona, but Napoli's first goal as well, is off of like an identical pattern. And it's something that we've seen Man City with Kevin De Bruyne do 100 times. So in possession, Barcelona are in this 3-2-5 shape. Andres Christensen is a full-time midfielder now. Not sure when that happened or why, but here we are. He was next to Gundogan in possession. And then as Barcelona would push forward, they would form this flat five across the front line, and Jawau would be high and wide on the left side. Lamal would be high and wide on the right side. You'd have Fermín López and Rafinha in the half spaces. And the pattern of play that we saw the first goal for both teams come from, even with Napoli using a slightly different possession shape, is this, and this is straight out of Man City's playbook. You move the ball wide all the way to whoever is occupying the wing, whose like feet are on the sideline. You move the ball wide, that stretches the opposing back line out, right? That really extends them further and further towards the wing, which creates little pockets of space to then send a runner into the half space towards the end line to go reach. And that has been Kevin De Bruyne time and time again for Manchester City. Some of their patterns look a bit different now, City, but that was the early thing under Pep, was you move the ball wide, you send De Bruyne through to the half spaces, and then De Bruyne will then cut the ball back. Well, for both of these goals, Barcelona and Napoli sent runners into the half spaces, they cut the ball back, and the first goal for Barcelona, it's Fermín López, who finishes just crashing on the weak side of the box, and that sequence often ends with a box-crashing midfielder. And the exact same thing happens with Napoli. They get a goal off of the same pattern. It was like I was watching the game on replay, but everybody had switched colors or sides, or it was in a meet. I don't know. I couldn't figure out what it was. It was just wild to me that we saw both of these teams go and score basically an identical goal, and one that I'd seen Man City score a bunch of times. It was a fun, not entirely well-played game, but entertaining and lots of attacking quality in this one. I enjoyed it.
So, Joe, when you buy a flat-screen TV, like a Samsung top of the range TV has the best technology in it, and then like 2 years later,
this episode brought to you by Samsung. Yeah,
2 years later, that technology appears in like the Vizio one,
yes.
Right?
This episode Barcelona, brought
to you by Vizio. The Vizio version of Man City. Like 100%.
Yes,
they've learned that goal. Basically.
I didn't know if you were leading up to make fun of me or where we were going with that, Ryan. And I was down for whatever. That analogy is perfect. That is a spotless analogy. Barcelona are that team. Right, they do so much fun stuff, and Xavi obviously has Pep influences. That's to the surprise of zero people out there. It makes tons of sense, but this Barcelona team just can't do it at the same level. And the same goes with Napoli. Like, one thing that really shocked me with Napoli was how rough their rest defense was. Like, they really struggled after they turned the ball over to deal with Barcelona's transition attacks. And so Barcelona get the first goal from López, and they get the second one from Jawau 2 minutes later, and it comes off this counterattack that was very preventable. Napoli were slow to step to the ball. There was a huge gap between Lobotka, as their number six, who had gone up to press, and the center backs, and I think the weak side fullback in that moment as well. And so Lamal just had so much green grass to run into, and 10 seconds later, the ball's in the back of Napoli's net. So I would say Barcelona, Napoli, all these sort of Man City impersonators, and certainly both of them in this tie, they are the Vizio, Ryan. I love it.
Vizio Man City. There you go.
We're getting Arsenal Barcelona, aren't we? That's going to be the draw, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fine.
Do we like that?
Sure.
I just feel like
2012 has called it once its Champions League last 16 tieback.
It feels like the way we're talking
final,
about
baby.
It. See, there you go. A bunch of history, but also it feels like in the same way that we were like Joe's point about Arsenal, like maybe not going to be the most expansive team or the most fully entertaining team. I feel like Barcelona have similar issues, so put them together, that'll be fun. I feel like we could get a very interesting draw. If we got Arsenal-Barcelona, I'm going to spoil the rest of the results. If we got Dortmund-Bayern, you could get that as a knockout round game. You could get Atletico-Real Madrid as one, and you could get City-PSG. There we go.
Cool.
All the big derbies, including the yeah. Oil State derby.
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. I believe the draw is on Friday, March 15th, by the way, listener.
I already did it. So it's fine.
Oh, cool.
Just one final point on this.
Don't worry about it. Wait, we're all done.
Just one final point on this match. Did anyone catch Aurelio De Laurentiis' interview before this game on CBS? So he was speaking to Guillaume Balaguer, and he said that the players were going to get €10 million if they made it through this tie, which obviously they didn't, so he kept that money in his pocket. But he also mentioned, and this was interesting, he also mentioned how important it was to win this game, because if you make the quarterfinals, if Napoli had made the quarterfinals, they would have been into the 2025 Club World Cup. That was the first time I'd ever heard a manager or a president or whoever mention that as an incentive. I hadn't even considered that. So that got me thinking, is the Club World Cup going to be a thing? Like, are we going to be caught by surprise here?
Well, Graham, this has been a narrative for a few teams. I think Barcelona have got this in their minds as well, because I heard elsewhere that it's worth 50 million to a team to get into this new expanded Club World Cup. So a lot of these teams are right now trying to firm up their place in it, which is great. Isn't that awesome? I love it.
So he actually wasn't really being that generous, De Laurentiis, with his 10 million, his 10 million euro bung. He was gonna, increase that revenue by five times, by fivefold.
I thought you were going to talk about De Laurentiis. Maybe I'm conflating it with the Serie A game at the weekend. There was a player where he pulled away from an interview and said he's not giving interviews.
Oh no, that was this game. This was this
game.
Was
that this one?
Yeah, because he's going to get sanctioned by UEFA for it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I knew there was some crazy De Laurentiis action, as there usually is. But Graham, Napoli, they're out. They're seventh in Serie A, 28 points off the lead. They're on their third manager of the season in Francesco Calzona.
Mm.
Cool.
Could this have gone worse? Like genuinely, Graham, could this season have gone any worse than any reality for Napoli? I think the answer is no.
Not really. I guess Osimhen could have left in January or Skira or something like that. But yeah, managerially it's a... it's a complete car crash. Just give the job to Spalletti's duck, honestly. Just get it done.
Old Snow White the duck. We miss you so. Let's take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to look at all the Wednesday action, including another shootout and Dortmund going through. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Total Soccer Show, we are reviewing the Champions League, and we go now to the Wandanara Stadium in Madrid. I think that's what it's called, Graham. Atletico Madrid 2, Inter 1, a 2-2 draw after lots of minutes, including extra time, Joe. Atleti winning 3-2 on penalties in this one. Plenty of drama here as well. Graham, what did we make of the flow of this one? I mean, the Arsenal game was quite tense. This one had attention to it too, did it not?
So did you find this one more enjoyable than the Porto game? I'm just trying to gauge here your enjoyment level. Or did you spend most of the match stressing out about how all the people were going to get home and whether there'd be enough trains for them to get out of the stadium?
On our private chat, I was worried that this game was going late local time and I wondered how public transportation would handle it. But apparently that worry was allayed by Graham's experience of the Madrid metropolitan transport system. I am loath to say I enjoyed an Atletic game more than an Arsenal game, but I think I did, Graham.
This is your anti-Simeone agenda, though.
Correct.
You just can't give him any. He's a lovable scamp. What is it that you don't like about him, Ryan Bailey?
98 World Cup is the answer to that question.
We've only got about 30 minutes left on this
podcast.
It's
because he had the audacity to put his leg in the way of David Beckham's violent outburst at him, wasn't it? That's the reason. Anyway, we're going over.
We don't let these things go.
We're going
by
over
the way,
all ground.
Graham, Simeone, another stat for you, never lost a home match in the Champions League knockout stage. Wow, mind blown.
It's astonishing. Here's another one. Atletico Madrid in their entire history have had 23 knockout matches ties in the Champions League. He has been manager for 21 of them.
Wow.
Which is incredible. He's basically just that club at that point, even down to the way that the fans react to them. So one of my favourite things, we will actually talk about the football soon, I promise, but one of my favourite things from this game was, so once when Inter Milan scored, all their fans held up their phones with like the lights on. You know how you see that at concerts? That must be a thing that they do.
Like a scissor
and
concert.
Obviously Atletico Madrid
respond
immediately. Respond immediately. So it out of pettiness, all the Atletico Madrid fans now have now celebrate with their phones, and at full time they were doing, they all had their phones held up, which apparently Dermot Corgan on Twitter was saying that is not a thing that Atletico Madrid fans do. That was purely to wind up
it
the Atletico Madrid Milan fans. He has permeated an entire fan base, Diego Simeone, and I'm totally here for it.
There is that kind of pettiness in elsewhere in soccer, Graham. The 2013 Champions League final at Wembley between Dortmund and Bayern, the celebrating Bayern fans singing Three Lions.
Love it.
At full volume at Wembley Stadium in an all-German final. That was banter on a Simeone level, I would say.
Sensational scenes. Surely you appreciate that on some level. But anyway, let's talk about this match a little bit. This is what I wanted from this tie when it first came out the hat. The first leg felt a bit like both teams were waiting for the second leg. I certainly felt like that in terms of how Atleti played that match. I don't think they played a very good game at San Siro. This was much more like it in my eyes. Two teams who are at their best when they can attack quickly with intent and physicality. Two teams who do a lot of hard running and runs in behind, and you had the crowd and two very animated managers on the touchline. So between this and the Arsenal-Porto match, my faith has been restored in this season's Champions League because I very much enjoyed this.
This was definitely a game where I was happy we got rid of away goals. Because when Inter scored, it did feel for that moment like, okay, this might be it. I'm not sure Atleti will be able to get three goals or two goals, and then realizing, yeah, 1 minute later, that's not what they need. But then, yes, two minutes later, I think.
Yeah.
And is it Pavar who fails to like make actual good contact, and then it goes to Griezmann? I for sure thought this was going to be offside. Then it stands, and then suddenly it starts to feel like, oh, okay, so we're back to level pegging, but it's still a long way to go for Atleti. And then maybe 5 minutes into the second half, it just fully felt like, oh, they're going to do this. They're definitely going to force extra time at some point. And at certain points, it felt like maybe they're going to do even more than that. So I think the way Atleti just kept grinding and grinding and grinding, and the belief was there, and it didn't boil over into frustration. It stayed at just sort of the backing of the home crowd. And I think Simeone, to your point, Graham, like, they definitely feed off of his energy and the way he sort of becomes a theatrical player in animating that stadium and in animating the team and in collapsing onto the ground when shots aren't taken the way he thought they should have been. I don't know. I think it just, they mirror each other really well, and it creates this great environment to watch soccer. And so it gave us everything we wanted, including a well-taken penalty shootout.
It was indeed.
For one
we'll
team.
Get to that. We'll get to that. Yeah, definitely just one team. Joe, can you sell me on Atleti and why I should enjoy watching them, please?
So if folks have watched Atletico Madrid in big games recently, they'll realize that they're absolutely not just a bunker and counter team. Like, if Ryan, if you watch this game in any level of detail, we saw them pressing Inter Milan from the jump, pressing through midfield, Hermoso at the left-sided center-back spot in possession to shift towards that phase of play. Steps forward, Griezmann at this point is sort of like a pure number 10, drifting around the field, and we saw Morata start in this game. Depay comes on later in the match. He's pulling the strings. There is so much quality in this team. You get Koke playing those through balls in midfield. Atleti get a bad rap because they have the reputation, and a lot of it is well-earned, of being this Diego Simeone team. Like, they sort of do embody his personality on the field in that they're gritty, they're animated, they're hard to play against. All those things are true, but you can't be an elite team. I believe this pretty strongly. You can't be an elite team competing for Champions League trophies without being able to do something else. And Atleti very much can do something else. They progress the ball well. They take chances in possession. They take chances out of possession. The one thing that still holds me back about feeling great about this team is that they're really not great in the final third. They have the individual brilliance to get them there. And Griezmann, man, the run he makes on that first goal is just stupid. It's so good. He's hoping that the ball is going to get to him. And it does. It is fantastic off-ball movement. They have players who can do damage in the final third. But especially early on in this match, it was cross. Yeah. Like, that is still their thing. They don't have those detailed patterns and like, sort of, reads in the final third, like you almost would imagine an NFL quarterback having. They don't have that check down list of going through and figuring out, okay, the ball's going here, then I'm moving here. It's much less structured and more improvised, which is not unique to Atleti, but to the extent of which they are improvised, it is a little unique. But man, like, some of the passes that this team plays, they'll play with the ball on the ground, they'll build from the back. Like, there's just a lot to like about this team, and I really, really enjoyed this game because I love Inter. I love watching them, and selfishly, I wish they'd advance. We did jinx them with the big thing. Sorry, folks, that's on us. But, like, Atleti can play a little bit as well. They don't always play, but they did in this game.
Yeah, we got a quick answer on that big thing episode, right? Can Atletico and Inter win the Champions League? Answer no, a week later. But yeah, totally agree with what you were saying, Joe, about Atleti and their attacking sequences. They're a bit of a weird team like that because they are not... I mean, if they are a defensive-minded team now under Simeone, they're not a very good one. They've conceded 51 goals in all competitions this season. They've conceded more goals than they've played games in the Liga this season. A lot of those goals come away from home, where their record is atrocious. But there has been a shift in the way that they're playing under Simeone in the last couple seasons. What I do think was an important moment for Atleti, with regards to what you were saying there, Joe, about their attack, was the introduction of Memphis. So that might be stating the obvious. He scores the goal that sends it to extra time. But even beyond that, I thought until he came on, it was just too slow from Atleti. There was no real urgency to their possession play. And what Memphis coming on did was it gave them someone who was willing to take a risk or beat a man or take a shot to kind of break things open. So I know he scores the winner from making a run into kind of like the penalty spot area. But before that, he'd frequently been the player to front up Inter's first line of defence. And until he comes on, it's largely Koke who's doing that, who obviously is able to pick a pass, but you can't really rely on him to do that every single time, especially when he's got like six players in front of him. Memphis is much more likely to drop a shoulder and beat a man or take a shot or just try something a little bit different. So I thought that was really significant in that period of the match was Memphis coming on at that time.
I still have to believe that Inter are just fully kicking themselves. Obviously, yeah, they go out in the shootout. Obviously, it's not the result they wanted. But to Joe's point, Atleti can be really aggressive, and I had that same note, that they're just committing numbers to the press, but also when they win the ball back, they had routinely 9 and sometimes even 10 outfield players within like 35 to 40 yards of Inter's goal. They were really committing numbers high, and I feel like that sort of explains how Inter are able to get the goal the way they do, and in that moment, I fully felt like, okay, Atleti are trying to do something different, which I now realize is not that different for them. But it was like Atleti are being expansive, they're pressing high, and that's going to leave them vulnerable. And I just have to believe Inter fully kicking themselves for letting that door back open, essentially. Because if they don't make that mistake, if they don't make the couple different mistakes they do in the lead up to Atleti's goal, I don't know how this plays out. I don't know if Atleti are able to kind of overcome that initial deficit. If they're 1-0 down in halftime or like with 40 minutes to go, I think it's just a different animal. And so in some ways, I think Inter beat Inter. And then in a lot of ways, Atleti beat Inter at the same time.
I can't recall a match that's had a moment of such like concise whiplash as this one, where when Inter score, I'm like, oh, they've got this.
Yeah, right.
They're going through. Then Atleti score, and obviously there's a long way of the match to go. And once you get to the shootout, you can't really call that. But once Griezmann scores the equaliser, immediately I'm thinking, oh, Atleti have got this. I've seen this one before. I can't really recall a match that's just turned on two moments like that. I don't know what Joe thinks from a tactical point of view. I wasn't impressed at all by the Inter performance from the Griezmann goal onwards. It just was not proactive enough. I've read some of the Italian press this morning. They are scathing of Simeone and Zaghi's approach to essentially kind of see this one out. This is a team who have the ability to control games and really diffuse situations like this one. It just didn't really feel... Maybe obviously football is more difficult than just saying you should do this thing. Maybe they wanted to do this thing and weren't capable of doing it. But to my eye, it just didn't feel like they were very interested in controlling this game. It was just very, very passive. You look at the Memphis goal. Yes, it is a wonderful pass by Koke into Memphis. And the touch is great and the finish isn't bad either from Memphis. But there are four players within 5 yards of Koke and then another line of defensive players behind that. And they allow him the time that he needs, 25 yards out from goal, to pick that pass. There's just not enough pressure on the ball. So just too passive from Inter when they have the ability. And we've seen from them this season, they have the capability to control games.
Yeah, they really did ease off in the second half. 45% possession for Inter in the second half. Like they were not trying to take the game. It was flipped in the first 45 minutes with 55 for Inter and 45 for Atleti. I just didn't think this was a good performance from Inter in basically any facet of the game. There were some tactical decisions from Inzaghi that I didn't quite understand, or at least it maybe didn't have the desired effect. So one of the things I noticed early on is that Benjamin Pavard, right center back in a 3-5-2 shape for this Inter team, was pushing really high up the field as a right wing back. And that was happening when Hakan Çalhanoğlu was dropping into the back line. And at times you'd see Barella drop into the back line. And then there was almost no midfield through the midfield for Inter Milan. And I think some of the idea was they were trying to pull Atleti's defensive shape around. They were trying to create extra space between the lines. Almost like what we talked about, not exactly the same, but at a high level, maybe a little similar, to what we talked about PSG doing with Dembele against Sociedad, where you drop a player in with the express intent to pull the opposing defensive shape with you to then create extra space between the lines. Except it just didn't work. And not because the space wasn't there, and it wasn't always there, but it was sometimes. But then Inter just weren't sharp with their possession playing. All this ties to, I think, when we talk about passiveness, whatever that word is. When we talk about a team being passive.
Passiveness, I believe it is.
There it is. Taylor gets it. Yeah. When we talk about a team being passive, I tend to think first about, like, oh, they weren't pressing enough. And maybe that was true for Inter in this game, but they're not really a high-pressing team. I think they were passive through their poor possession play. They were passive, each player, really, with their own individual actions. You had turnovers through midfield. You had turnovers in the wing-back areas. You had trouble breaking the press. The front line couldn't control the ball. Not a banner game for Thuram or for Lautaro Martinez, really, when you look at this one on the whole.
Oh, Lautaro.
Yeah, the penalty is a brutal moment.
Crumbles more than Gonzalo Higuain when the world is watching. Yeah. Every time. He's got a record of that.
This performance was just the worst time for Inter to have one of the worst performances I've seen from them this year.
There was some interesting analysis I saw, because the shootout, obviously Inter didn't cover themselves in glory. Klaassen and Lautaro missing. Sal missed as well for Atleti, to be fair. But they looked at the run-up, when Lautaro's walking to the spot and he tries to pick up the ball and dribble it and he misses. He can't even pick up the ball. It's like he's that nervous at that point. And then Captain Hindsight, once again, Taylor, analysing that moment. I think it was Rio Ferdinand, possibly, on the UK broadcast, Graham, if I'm not mistaken, was saying you could tell at that point it wasn't going to go his way, which is easy to say at that point.
I mean, yeah. But I think also that shootout was just, it was very weird, is the best way I can put it, for Inter. Just that Hakan Çalhanoğlu steps up to start the shootout and just buries it. Like, very similar to Odegaard, just emphatically finishes it. And then Memphis does the exact same thing and does the exact same, like, picking up of the crowd. But from that moment on for Inter, none of the finishes are particularly good. Obviously, they missed three of the next four. But even at Cherby's, it was sort of right down the middle. It was the exact same places that Sanchez and Klaassen had put theirs previously. It's one of the only times that Oblak goes the wrong way. But they all just were sort of in step again at that height where, and maybe this isn't a common thing, or maybe it is, but just to, like, reiterate, basically in a shootout, or if you're taking a penalty, if you can put the ball on the ground towards the corner, it's going to be hard for the keeper to get, like, down that low and, like, stretch all the way out to make that save. So that's a hard place to put it. If you can rifle into the top corner, that's obviously pretty good as well. But putting it, like, 3 feet off the ground, so maybe 5 feet off the ground and not fully into the corner, is the easier of places to save for the goalkeeper, because that just requires a, like, lunge to the right, a lunge to the left. And that three of the five for Inter are in that exact spot, like, slightly to the right of the goalkeeper, to the goalkeeper's right. It doesn't require a ton. I don't want to take anything away from Oblak, but, like, even the first save or the second save he has, he's like, he's over-dived, basically, and just gets it with a trailing hand. And that means that Inter sort of put it in the wrong spot and didn't put power behind it either. That, like, if you put power behind that shot, if he gets a hand to it sort of meekly as he's diving the wrong way, it's still going in. So I just think Inter in the moment, it felt like they had already lost before the shootout began. Whereas Atleti, Saul does miss his, as you said, Ryan, but Memphis rockets his, Riquelme buries his emphatically, and then Correa, it's a little help, but it's a good finish all the same. So it felt like Atleti just raised their game heading into the shootout, and Inter, I think, just did the opposite and kind of choked it away at the end. Lautaro Martinez wants to blame the spot. The immediate turnaround and point to the spot. I'm like, it wasn't me. It was the spot's fault. I'm not sure how much that's going to work.
Yeah, we're buying that. Yeah. Also rough for Inter because two of the players who missed penalties were brought off the bench, I'd imagine, with the purpose of taking a penalty. David Klaassen and Alexi Sanchez. Simeone and Zaghi on the sideline going, we need all the Premier League rejects to take penalties. Have we only got two? We need more.
One final question, Graham, for me on this game. Marcus Thuram in the incident with, was it Savic, Stefan Savic, when he was a little intimate with him, should we say?
I bet you enjoyed that. Was that your most enjoyable moment? The spirit of Vinnie Jones lives on.
100%. But we were led to believe there was a VAR review on it. Why is that not a card? A red card specifically? Is that not...
Mm, Did he endanger an opponent by doing? I mean, what line are we drawing
here? Assaulted an opponent, I'd say.
Was it reckless?
Yes. I would agree with Graham. I thought for sure that was going to be a red. I thought that was going to be the story of the game. Marcus Thuram gets sent off, and then all of the nice stuff we said about him, all of the positivity around the way he's played, gets kind of blown out of the water in one moment of foolishness. They laughed about it after the game. I think they laughed about it at full time, which maybe that's it. Maybe they just knew that it was just playful banter instead of an assault, which is what it was. Lautaro Martinez was the one to cover himself in the opposite of glory.
Zaghi takes him off immediately after that. He's like, yeah. You only get one ball squeeze in the Champions League.
And it's usually Simeone doing that.
Here's the thing, man. I'm not sure. Like, I don't love...
We're trying to keep this G-rated. It was so obvious and done in such slow motion that, like, I'm not sure it was the area that you just mentioned, Graham, but I don't love how many times I could clearly see what was happening. It was not my favorite thing.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, in like 4K, like ultra HD. It's tough to miss unless you're VAR, apparently.
Someone should get a Vizio. You should get a Vizio TV instead. It won't be so clear.
Very nice indeed. So there were two sides who were running away with their respective leagues who were dumped out on Wednesday. The other being PSV. Dortmund with a 2-0 win in their match. 3-1 on aggregate there. Sancho and Royce on target on the night. Foul B in the quarterfinals for the first time in 3 years. Graham, it was Jadon Sancho who was the player of the match. First Champions League goal since November 21.
Yeah, he was really feeling himself in the first half with some of the pieces of skill he was pulling off. Obviously scores the early goal. Two goals in two games for him. He scored at the weekend, didn't he? Against Wolfsburg.
Great goal.
I really hope that... So he goes off with an injury in this game. I really hope that injury is not too serious because it's starting to feel like he is finding his best form again, and it's fun to watch him when he's playing like this. This was a weird match. There was a lot to like about the way that Dortmund started this game. So you had Sancho on the left and Malin as a threat down the right side. As I've already mentioned, Sancho starts well. There was intensity to Dortmund's play. They were pressing high, particularly in the first kind of 5 minutes. They had a good opportunity before they score the goal, even though they score after 3 minutes. There's one that comes from winning the ball high up the pitch before that. I thought Sabitzer was playing well in midfield and giving Dortmund good presence. Mats Hummels was largely untroubled at the back. Matson was doing a good job of keeping Bakayoko quiet, also getting forward on a couple of occasions as well. But then as the match progressed, PSV started to find a foothold. They started to create opportunities. Lozano hits the post, although that was from distance, so I wouldn't really class that as like a clear opportunity. Bakayoko has a good shot at the near post as well. But the big sliding doors moment came right at the end when Luke de Jong, there's a nice 1-2 inside the box. He's maybe like a couple yards, 2 or 3 yards inside the box. He's got clear sight of goal and he just skews it high over the bar. And then seconds later, so that goal would have taken it to extra time. Seconds later, 4th minute of stoppage time, Dortmund score their second goal after a slip by Jordan Tese, and then the tie is over. So it was a strange game because I do think Dortmund were the more impressive team. They're certainly the stronger team over the tie and going into the quarterfinals, but PSV will look at some opportunities, and it's not like they racked up the expected goals in this game. It wasn't like they were battering down the door, but there were a couple of opportunities that could have gone their way in this game.
Joe, you concur with that? How did you feel about PSV's outing here?
I thought they were a little better than Graham's giving them credit for, but not in a blindingly obvious way. Like, I don't feel super strongly about it. I thought they were maybe the slightly better team on the day. But ultimately, in this sport, all the tactical stuff that I love to nerd out about, all of the you know stuff you can glean from watching these games, it comes down to who puts the ball in the back of the net. Like, as basic as that is, I don't think Dortmund were two goals better than PSV in this game. I don't think you'll find anybody who watched this game that thinks that. But the reality is, Jadon Sancho scored a very nice goal 3 minutes into the match. PSV didn't take their chances. That shot from Luke de Jong, very much not a sitter, but very clearly was the best chance of the game. Emre Can it is, I think, who's right on de Jong's back, and he doesn't have a lot of time to shoot. He's just coming off that 1-2. Still, it was a good chance, and he doesn't convert it, and he has converted a lot of those good chances for PSV this year as their leading goal scorer. And then all of a sudden a slip at the other end and Marco Reus finishes the deal off. Like, I can go in and analyze, you know, I liked PSV's 4-3-3. I thought Dest was really sharp on that side. I don't like Tillman as a winger, but he didn't really have to go and take a bunch of people on. So it was kind of fun. Like, you can go in and talk about all that stuff, and a lot of that stuff is relevant. But the reality is PSV didn't put the ball in the back of the net and they lost this game. And that's probably fine because I think both these teams are going to lose in the next round anyway.
Yeah, it's probably true. I think there will be, you highlighted Tillman on as a winger on the left side. I think
he's not good there. Regret. Like, that's just not his thing.
There'll be some regret from Peter Bosz after this match, as highlighted by the fact he makes the change at halftime and Chucky Lozano comes on and Tillman has shifted more centrally and it's Lozano on the left side. And I just think PSV's, the way that they play, they need that verticality, they need a little bit of width, and it wasn't until Lozano came on that they found that. So yeah, I think there will be some regret there.
And you can't, I just don't think you can run a left wing of Sergiño Dest and Malik Tillman, because Tillman's not a guy who likes to take players on 1v1 like a traditional winger. He can progress the ball, sure, but he's not going to be super decisive in beating somebody 1v1 out wide and getting to the end line and cutting the ball back or cutting inside to get a shot of his own. He's much more of a connector and at times a playmaker than he is a shot getter for himself. And then Dest on that left side, as a right footer, that changes the dynamic of the wing. And so you're basically getting nothing, at least from those individual players. Not that Dest was bad. I don't think he was. I thought he was sharp in this game. But you're not getting a lot in the final third in terms of like raw chance creation and goal threat. And so I think that needed to change, and Bosz was right to recognize that change. But I guess with Tillman, you're hoping for a bit more control. It just didn't seem to fit, and PSV maybe put themselves a bit behind the eight ball. But I honestly think the biggest difference in this game is that one team had a Jadon Sancho level player in Jadon Sancho, and the other team did not. Like, the game was very, very close. I thought PSV were marginally better between the boxes, and Jadon Sancho puts them behind the eight ball early on.
Yeah. Taylor, you enjoying the reflective glory of Jadon Sancho doing it on the big stage?
It's such fun. It really is. It is interesting to see what will happen with him. If Dortmund will try to make that permanent again, or if Man United's plan to have him look good for Dortmund and then sell him on will work, maybe he gets another opportunity with the club now that there's new ownership in there, or 25% new ownership in there. But yeah, I thought it was really fun to see him really contribute in a meaningful way, obviously with the goal, but also just look sharp. It's a good finish. It's a confident finish. It's a thing that we haven't seen from him playing for Manchester United for quite some time. And he's had plenty of those with Dortmund. I thought he was the difference maker for them in that opening start, just that he had an efficiency that Daniel Malin doesn't really quite seem to have. He can get into really good opportunities, Malin. He can force saves, he can force corners, but he doesn't have that next level finishing that I think you need to reach that next level. I'm not saying Jadon Sancho does either on a consistent basis, but I think it's not surprising to me that Sancho just having a whack from 20 yards out, it's like the way he hits it. I think his shooting leg doesn't touch the ground after he shoots. It's like that smooth of a strike. It's really well taken. It's a really nice goal. Joe, I want to go back to PSV for a moment, though, because while I'm praising one player with whom I have some affiliation, I would like your thoughts on Malik Tillman overall. We've talked about him a little bit, Malik Tillman, starting on the wing, moving centrally. I wasn't as impressed by him in the first leg of this one, and I'm not sure I was impressed by him in this one. There still seems to be just that half-second delay in speed, in processing, that like sometimes that leads to a heavy touch, sometimes that leads to him holding the ball too much. But I can't tell if I've just started to see that, and that's all I now see. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts on his overall performance.
No, I'm pretty much exactly where you are, Taylor. I thought he was better in this leg than he was in the first leg, which is weird because obviously he draws that penalty in the first leg, but it's fluky, and I don't think he deserves any real credit for that. I'm still not all the way there on Tillman. What I will say is I think it's fantastic that he gets these kinds of games. The fact that he's been playing in the Champions League, the fact that he's been playing against some of the better opposition in the Eredivisie, although PSV are running away and have already run away with so much stuff domestically. Like, these are good exercises for him because his national team role, you know, we're a week away now from the U.S. taking on Jamaica. His national team role is growing. There's only two traditional wingers on Greg Berhalter's roster for the Nations League Final Four. It's just Pulisic and Weah. Nobody else is a traditional winger. And Tillman, I believe, gets listed with the forwards in that squad. So I don't think he's a winger. Even if he's playing as a nominal winger, he's still not going to do that kind of stuff. But it's good that he's getting these games in these minutes against high-level opposition, even though Dortmund, I don't think, are good relative to a lot of the rest of the teams in this competition. It's great that he's getting these opportunities because it will make him sharper in the long run, even if he's not there yet.
Yeah, definitely one of the top two Maliks to make Champions League headlines this week, I would say. Dortmund progressing through to the final eight, of course. Our Champions League quarterfinalists, Taylor, Real Madrid, Man City, Bayern Munich, PSG, Barcelona, Arsenal, Borussia Dortmund, and Atletico Madrid. Two English teams, two German teams, three Spanish teams, and a French team. No Italian teams in the final eight this time around. You've already, of course, picked the group draw, so UEFA will just go through the motions and confirm that tomorrow as we record. But quite a nice final eight there.
Is there one that you all would most like to see if you could get any draw happening? Like, what is one matchup you would really, really enjoy?
I'd like to see Bayern Real Madrid. I think that'd be fun, and we can just sort of toss Bayern to the side, which is, I'm not necessarily like itching for that to happen, but I think that's probably what would happen. And it gives you, it's the right balance of a team that in Bayern we don't really think is probably going to win this whole thing at this point, although it's not impossible, and a team in Real Madrid that I think we're all feeling stupid to pick against because you just don't do that with Real Madrid. So I'm willing to set Bayern aside for the benefit of getting a really nice matchup in the next round.
PSG Real Madrid, not really for any football reasons, just for the narrative for Mbappe against Real Madrid.
He'll just come out in a white kit. That's just what's going to happen. Yeah. He's just going to wear a Real Madrid kit.
Yeah, might as well just get to it now. Just do it now.
Halftime swap, like you'll get with like testimonials. He plays one half for PSG and then he puts
it's
on
a pre. It's a pre Real Madrid testimonial for Mbappe. Yeah. Those are all the
remind me. A quarterfinal stage, can teams play their own teams from their own leagues? Their own nations?
Yes, I think so. I don't think there's any restrictions at this point. Yeah.
So we've got Classico potential. We've got Classica potential here.
Oh, I'd love that as well. That'd be great.
Yeah, very nice indeed. Draw taking place on Friday, as we say. But that is our Champions League roundup at this time. Taylor Rockwell, thank you so much for your analysis and contributions.
Thank you, my friend.
Graham Ruthven, pleasure as always, my good man.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
And Joe Lowry, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Ryan.
And thank you, the mostest listener. Thank you for joining us on this one. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye!
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.